tough, tough Greeks. A half mile now. Syrian cavalrymen were still swirling in the ground between Belisarius and the oncoming Malwa. A Hunnish kind of sally, the general had asked for, and Huns couldn't have done it better. Advance, volley, retreat, but with the Parthian shot, firing arrows over the shoulder. Counterattack, volley, retreat. Swirl forward, swirl away. Kill, cripple, wound, and evade retaliation. Belisarius could finally see a few of the advancing Malwa. He could sense their frenzied rage at the Syrian tactics. Full of their own arrogance, the Malwa thought only of closing with this infuriating army of skirmishers. Their lead units were pushing ahead, maintaining no battle order. The Yetai enforcers scattered among them were not driving the troopers forward. There was no need. The Yetai themselves were seized up in that same heedless fury. The Malwa troops knew little of Mesopotamia, and the Yetai even less. Knew nothing of the crumbled bones which littered that soil, the bones of Roman soldiers, often enough, who had made their same mistake. Crassus and his legions had been slaughtered by the Parthians half a millennium before, not so very far away. Belisarius's main concern had been that the Malwa might precede their troops with rocket volleys. He hadn't been particularly worried about casualties as such. The Malwa rockets were much too erratic and inaccurate to fire genuine barrages. But he had been worried that the noise might panic some of his garrison troopers' horses. The mounts which his Constantinople soldiers rode were the steadiest available, true. But they had little of the training with gunpowder weapons which his Syrian and Thracian cavalry had enjoyed. It was obvious, however, that there would be no barrages. As he had hoped, the Syrians' light cavalry tactics had been too agile and confusing to give the Malwa Kshatriya a clear target. Now it was too late. The dust thrown up by thousands of horsemen, friend and foe alike, had completely obscured the front of the battlefield from the Malwa commanders in the center. They wouldn't even be able to see the charge of his Constantinople heavy cavalry. They would hear it, certainly. Even in the din of battle, a full charge by 2,000 cataphracts would shake the very earth. But the sound of thunder is not a suitable target for rockets, and the sound would be short-lived in any event. Once the cataphracts closed, rockets would kill more Malwa troops than Roman. Belisarius spurred his horse forward. No gallop, simply an easy canter. To either side, the garrison troopers matched the pace. There was no need any longer for the hecatontarchs and decarts to maintain a steady formation. The cataphracts' lines were as steady as if they had been drawn in ink. Battle was very near, and these were the same Greeks whose forefathers had marched in step at Marathon. 500 yards. Though they were closer, the enemy had disappeared completely, swallowed by the dust which hovered over the battlefield, unstirred by even a gentle breeze. 400 yards. Out of the dust galloped a small body of Arab cavalrymen. They headed straight for the oncoming Greeks. As they approached, Belisarius recognized the figure of Abu. The scout leader swept past the general, ululating fiercely. Blood dripped from a small gash on his cheek, but the old warrior seemed otherwise unharmed. A moment later, Abu drew his horse alongside Belisarius. His mount's flanks were heaving and sheened with sweat, but the horse seemed not in the least exhausted. Abu certainly wasn't. "The Lakhmids are done," he cried gaily. "Beaten like dogs! We whipped the curs into the river!" Belisarius met that savage grin with his own smile. "All of them?" Abu sneered. "Lakhmids. Stinking Lakhmids are not Bedouin, General Belisarius. River rats. Oasis huddlers. Die of fright in the good desert. I'm sure most of them are scurrying down this bank of the Euphrates. Doesn't matter. You won't see them again. Not for days, if ever. Nothing else, they'll get lost." An exquisite sneer. "Camel fuckers, the lot. Don't even have the excuse of being perverts. Lakhmids are just too stupid to know the difference between a woman and a camel." A royal sneer. "Hard to blame them, of course. Lakhmid women are uglier than camels. Meaner, too." 300 yards. There was a sudden rush of Syrians, the last diehards finally breaking off with the enemy. Then a second or two later, the first ranks of the Malwa cavalry appeared in the dust. galloping forward in a full and furious charge. Belisarius caught a glimpse of Abu's gleaming eyes. At that moment, the old man truly seemed a pirate ogling a chest of gold. The general laughed. "Let them be, Abu. Our job now." He jerked his head backward. "Be off. Regroup your men. Rejoin Cootsies and the Syrians. I want to be sure you're there to cover us, especially on the left when we make our own retreat. I don't want any Malwa, not one, to get into those woods and find my surprise." Abu snorted.
"Worry about something else, General. Worry about anything else. No Malwa will get into those woods."
He began reining his horse around, taking a last glance at the Malwa. 250 yards away.
"God be with you, General Belisarius."
Hundreds of Malwa cavalry were visible now. Perhaps 1,000. It was hard to gauge since they were so disorganized. The enemy troopers finally caught sight of the heavily armored cataphracts approaching them. Some apparently began to have second thoughts about the reckless advance, judging from their attempts to rein in their mounts, but those doubters were instantly quelled by the Yeti. The Malwa army, more of a mob, really, continued its headlong charge. 200 yards. The cataphracts drew their bows, notched their arrows. Time. Belisarius gave the order. The cornisons blew wild and loud. The Roman cataphracts brought their mounts to a halt. As soon as the horses had steadied, all 2,000 cavalrymen raised up in their stirrups. With the full power of their chests and shoulders, they drew back their bows and fired in unison. The cataphracts were 4 ranks deep. The ranks were staggered in a checkerboard pattern to allow each rank a clear line of fire. With the gaps between the regiments, which provided escape routes for the retreating Syrians, the Constantinople mounted archers covered well over a mile of battlefront. Firing in a coordinated volley at that short range, their arrows swept the front ranks of the oncoming Malwa like a giant scythe. At least half of the arrows missed, burying their cruel warheads in the soft soil. But hundreds didn't, and most of those hundreds brought death and horrible injury. No bows in the world were as powerful as cataphract bows, few arrowheads as sharp, and none as heavy. The Malwa staggered. Many shouted and screamed, some with shock and agony, others with fear and disbelief. Their light armor had been like so much tissue against those incredible arrows. Belisarius motioned. Again the cornisons blew. The cataphracts sheathed their bows, reached back, and drew their lances. Within seconds, they sent their horses back into motion. Not more than 100 yards separated the two armies when the Romans began their charge. Those yards shrank like magic. Ironically, it was the Malwa, the bleeding, battered, mangled Malwa, who closed most of that distance. Those Malwa in the front ranks who had survived the volley were driving their horses forward at a furious gallop, desperate to close before more arrows could be brought to bear on them. It was a natural reaction. An inevitable reaction, actually, as Belisarius had known it would be. But it was disastrous nonetheless. A man on a galloping horse must concentrate most of his attention on staying in the saddle. That is especially true for men like the Malwa cavalry, who did not possess the stirrups of their Roman enemies. Men in that position, for all the dramatic furor of their charge, are simply not in position to wield their weapons effectively. For their part, the Roman cataphracts did not advance at a gallop. They spurred their horses forward in a canter, a pace easy to ride while they concentrated on their murderous work. They set their feet in the stirrups, leaned into the charge, positioned their heavy lances securely, and aimed the spear points. When the two cavalry forces met, seconds later, the result was sheer slaughter. Malwa horsemen were better armed and armored than Malwa infantry, but by Roman or Persian standards, they were not much more than light cavalry. Their armor was mail, flimsy at that, and simply covered their torsos. The cataphract armor was heavy scale, covering not only the torso, but the left arm and the body down to mid-thigh. Malwa helmets were leather caps, reinforced with scale. The cataphracts wore German-style Spangenhelm, their heads protected by segmented steel plate. The Malwa lances, in the tradition of stirrupless cavalry, were simply long and slender spears. The Greeks were wielding lances twice as heavy and half again as long. The Yetai were better equipped than the common Mawa cavalrymen, yet they also were hopelessly outclassed as lancers, and would have been even had Belisarius not refitted his cavalry with the stirrups which Aid had shown him in a vision. The Romans shattered the Malwa charge across the entire line. Some Malwa in the first ranks, on both edges of the battlefront, were able to veer aside. The majority were simply hammered under. Over 500 Malwa cavalrymen died or were seriously injured in that brutal collision. Half of them were spitted on lances. The other half, within seconds, were being butchered by cataphract swords and axes. And here, too, history showed. Malwa hand weapons had none of the weight of Roman swords and axes. The Malwa had only months of experience fighting Persian Dagans. The Romans, centuries. There were perhaps 6,000 Malwa cavalrymen directly involved in this first major clash of the two armies. In less than 2 minutes between the volley and the lance charge, they had suffered casualties in excess of 15%, a horrendous rate measured by the standards of any human army in history. Then the bloodletting worsened. The front ranks of the Malwa had been brought to a complete halt. Many of them, along with their horses, were spilled to the ground. Those still in the saddle were off balance, bewildered, shocked. The Malwa charging from behind had seen little of the battle due to the dust and the noise. Still driving their horses, they slammed into the immobilized mass at the front. Thousands of Malwa horsemen were now hopelessly tangled up and being driven willy-nilly against the Roman line. Belisarius had been planning to call the retreat as soon as the initial clash was done. But now, seeing the confusion in the Malwa ranks, he ordered a standing fight. The cornisons blew again. The rear ranks of the cataphracts moved up, filling out the front line. The gaps were closed. The horsemen were almost shoulder to shoulder. Flanked by Valentinian and Anastasius, Belisarius took a place in the center of the line. His lance had already been discarded. The Yetai that lance had spitted in the first clash had taken it with him as he fell to the ground. The general drew his sword, not the spatha he generally favored, but the long Persian-style cavalry sword which he carried in a baldric. He rose in the stirrups and struck down a Malwa before him. The heavy sword cut through the man's helmet and split his skull. Belisarius jerked loose the sword, struck another foe. Another. Another. As before in battle, Aid was assisting him, giving the general almost superhuman reflexes and an uncanny ability to perceive everything sharply and clearly. But the assistance was almost moot. This battle, this brawl, called for strength and endurance, not speed and agility. No matter. Belisarius was a big man and a powerful one. His endurance had been shaped by the teachings and training of Morris, who considered stamina the soldier's best friend, and his skill with a sword by Valentinian. At no time in the ensuing fray did he fail to cut down his opponent, and at no time was he in danger of being struck down himself. That would have been true even if Valentinian hadn't been there to protect him on the left, just as the giant Anastasius did on his right. The battle was as savage as any Belisarius had ever seen, on that scale at least, and he was no stranger to mayhem. It was more like butchers chopping meat than anything else. The Malwa at the front could barely wield their weapons, so great was the press. The Romans hammered them down, hammered the ones who were pushed atop the corpses, hammered the ones who came after them. At many places along the line, after a few minutes, the battle effectively ended. The Greeks could no longer reach live enemies due to the obstruction of the dead ones. The Malwa at the front began to recoil. The ones pressing from the rear had finally sensed the tide and eased away, allowing the men before them to stagger back. Belisarius, sensing the break in the battle, left off his merciless sword work. Quickly he scanned the front. He was in the very middle of the Roman ranks and could no longer see either end of the battle line, but he knew the danger. For all their losses, the Malwa greatly outnumbered his Constantinople troops. Whether from conscious direction by their commanders or the simple flow of individuals, they would soon be curling around his flanks. He gave two quick orders. The cornisons blew, then blew again. The first order was for the retrieval of casualties. The cataphracts, hearing that call, shouted their fury and contempt at the Malwa. It was as if the entire Constantinople unit was sneering as one man. "We whipped your fucking worthless butts. Now we'll take the time to gather up our own before we amble on our way. Fuck you, you don't like it? Try and do something about it." For all their braggadocio, the Greeks didn't linger at the task. They were veterans and knew as well as their general the danger of being outflanked before they could make their retreat. So, one cataphract aiding another, they quickly gathered up their casualties and draped them across their horses. It didn't take long, even though the Greeks took the time to collect the dead as well as the wounded. Their casualties had been incredibly light, much lighter than they had expected. Much lighter. They were almost shocked once they realized how few bodies they were to retrieve. The retreat started. Belisarius had been concerned about that retreat before the battle. It is always difficult to keep soldiers, even the best of soldiers, under control at such times. There is a powerful tendency for men to speed up, anxious to gain distance from a pursuing enemy. Whether quickly or almost imperceptibly, a retreat can easily turn into a chaotic rout. Not this time. Within seconds, Belisarius knew he had nothing to fear. The Constantinople men, it was obvious, didn't even consider themselves to be retreating. They were simply leaving, because there was nothing more to be done at the moment. An easy canter, no more. The ranks reformed, even dressed their lines. Belisarius took his place at the rear during that retreat, just as he had taken a place at the front during the charge. The Greeks noticed again, and a great cheer surged through their ranks. "Belisarius! Belisarius!" He smiled, he even waved, but he took no other notice of the acclaim. He spent most of the time during that almost leisurely retreat staring over his shoulder, watching the enemy, gauging, assessing. He caught sight of Syrian and Arab units charging forward, ready to provide covering fire for the cataphracts. He waved them off. There was no need. The Malwa were pursuing, true, but it was not a furious, frenzied charge led by eager warriors. It was a sodden, leaden, sullen movement, driven forward by screaming Yetai. The Malwa cavalrymen had had enough of Romans for the moment. Belisarius turned back, satisfied, and glanced at the sun. It was not yet noontime. He thought the Malwa commanders wouldn't be able to drive their army back into battle for at least 2 hours, possibly three. Plenty of time. He had taken no pleasure in the killing. He never had, in any battle he had ever fought, but he did take satisfaction in a job well done, and he intended to do the same again in 2 hours, possibly three. Plenty of time for a craftsman at his trade. Chapter 19. 2.5 hours later, the enemy began taking positions for the assault on the villa. The Malwa forces lined up on the open ground east of the royal compound at a distance of 0.5 miles. The front lines were composed of cavalry regulars backed by Yetai. The rocket wagons, guarded by the Kushans, were brought to a halt 50 yards behind the front ranks. The Kshatriya, overseen by Mahaveda priests, removed the tarpaulins covering the wagons and began unloading rockets and firing troughs. Within a few minutes, they had the artillery devices set up. There were 18 of the rocket troughs, erected in a single line spaced 30 feet apart. From a room on the second floor of the villa, Belisarius studied the Malwa formation with his telescope. Standing just behind him were the top officers of the Syrian and Constantinople troops forted up in the imperial compound, Buzes and Kutses, Agathias and Cyril. They were listening intently as Belisarius passed on his assessment of the situation. The general began by examining the rockets, but spent little time on that problem. Once the first 2 or 3 had been erected, he was satisfied that he understood them perfectly. The rockets were the same type he had seen, at much closer range, during the sea battle he had fought against pirates while traveling to India on a Malwa embassy ship. In that battle, the rockets had wreaked havoc on the Arab ships. But he told his officers he didn't think they would have that effect here. Most of the damage done by the rockets in the pirate battle, he explained, lowering the telescope for a moment, was incendiary. The pirate galleys, like all wooden boats, were bonfires waiting to happen. Seeing the puzzlement on the faces of Buzes and Kutses, the 2 Constantinople officers chuckled.
Farm boys, snorted Cyril. You think because a boat's floating on the water that she won't burn? Shit. The planks are made of the driest wood anyone can find, and what's worse, they're caulked with pitch, concluded Agathias. Like his fellow Greek, the Kiliarch was smirking, that particular unmistakable, insufferable smirk which seafarers the world over bestow upon landlubbers. Not to mention the cordage and the sails, added Cyril. Boozies and Cootsies, Thracian leaders of a Syrian army, took no offense at the Greek sarcasm. On some other day, they might, but not on the day when those same Greeks had given the enemy such a thorough pounding. They simply grinned, shrugged at their ignorance, and studied the interior of the villa with new and enlightened eyes. A different matter altogether, isn't it? Commented Belisarius. Under the fancy trappings and elaborate decorations, the royal compound was about as fireproof as a granite tor. The walls were made of kiln-fired brick, and the sloping roof was covered with tiles. Neither would burn. Those bricks and tiles had been made in ovens, and he was quite sure the thick walls could withstand the explosive power of the rocket's relatively small warheads. True, the roof tiles would probably shatter under a direct hit by a rocket. Belisarius didn't think there would be many such hits, if any. He knew from experience that the Malwa rockets were not only erratic in their trajectories, but erratic in their destruction as well. They had no contact fuses. They simply exploded whenever the burning fuel reached the warhead. In order to shatter the roof, a rocket would have to hit directly, not at a glancing angle, and explode at just the right time. The likelihood of that happening, in his estimation, was not much greater than being hit by lightning. And if, against all odds, a rocket should score a direct hit. Might break in the roof tiles, commented Boozies. Belisarius shrugged. The tiles are supported by heavy beams. Wooden beams, yes, but these beams aren't anything like the thin planks of pirate galleys. They're much thicker, and what's more important, not saturated with inflammable pitch. He began studying the positions of the Malwa cavalry now, again passing on his conclusions. They'll start with a rocket barrage and then follow it up with a direct assault. A moment's silence, then, I thought so. They're dismounting now. It'll be an infantry attack. Those are cavalry, protested Cootsies. Belisarius pressed his lips together to keep from smiling. He remembered from 3 years before that Cootsies and Boozies had been trained in the cavalry tradition. The young Thracian commander, it was obvious, had still not quite abandoned his contempt for foot fighting. His brother, however, had. Don't be stupid. We've been training our own men to be dragoons. Why shouldn't the Malwa? Well said, murmured Belisarius. For a moment he took his eye from the telescope and glanced at Cootsies. You're about to see why I insisted on training our cavalry to fight on foot. I know you think that was a waste of time. He drove over Cootsies' little protest. But the reason I did so is because I knew the time would come when we'd be able to arm those dragoons with grenades and hand cannons, I'm hoping. He nodded toward the enemy, visible through the window. They already have grenades. The Kshatriya are starting to pass them out to the regulars. He took up the telescope again and continued his scrutiny. They'll come in waves, probably be one grenadier for every 10 soldiers. The Yetai will be scattered through the lines in small squads, driving the regulars forward and pressing the assault. Some of the Kshatri will be in those lines too, but most of them will stay at the center with the priests manning the rockets. They'll also help the Kushans guard the wagons. They might... Damn. He stiffened, staring through the telescope intently. Damn, he repeated. They're bringing up the Kushans, all 2,000 of them. On foot? Asked Agathias. Belisarius lowered the telescope, nodded, then with a bit of a rueful smile. Kushans, in my experience, don't have any fetishes when it comes to fighting. On foot, on horse, on boats, it doesn't matter to them. Whatever, they'll do it well. Very well. He turned away from the window. It was obvious from his stance and expression that he had reached a decision. His officers gathered closer. This changes things, Belisarius announced. As you know, I'd wanted to wait until tomorrow before bringing in Morris and his boys.
He tapped the palm of his hand with the telescope, emphasizing his words. We're going to beat these bastards one way or the other, but I want more than that. I want to pulverize them. The best way to do that is to rout them early in the morning so we've got a full day for pursuit. The officers nodded. All of them, even the two young brothers, were experienced combatants. They knew that a battle won at the end of the day was a battle half won. The kind of relentless driving pursuit which could utterly destroy a retreating enemy was simply impossible once daylight was gone. Agathius glanced out the window. It's still before noon, he mused. If the battle starts soon enough... Belisarius shook his head. I'd wanted to let the Malwa spend all day hammering their heads against us here. Bleed them dry, exhaust them, then hit them at dawn with a massive flank attack by Morris and Carouche. The attack would break their army, and then we'd sally out of the villa and drive over them. He saw that his officers still didn't understand. He didn't blame them. Their brief experience with Malwa soldiers had not prepared them for the Kushans. The Kushans are a different breed. They won't come at us in a mass, chivied by Yetai, depending on their grenades to do the work. They'll come at us like the best kind of Roman infantry would attack this place. Of the officers standing around him, Boozies was the most familiar with Belisarius's infantry tactics. The general saw dawning comprehension in his face. Shit, muttered the young Thracian. He glanced around the room. The villa's not a fortress when you come down to it. The fortifications we jury-rigged were designed to fend off grenades, not... Belisarius finished the thought. Not 2,000 of the finest foot soldiers anywhere in the world charging in squads, aiming to push into every door and portal so they can use their swords and spears. Cyril scowled. Let them. I don't care how good they are. We're not lambs ourselves, General. Our cataphracts can fight on foot. Just watch. With us to back up the Syrians, we'll chop those... Belisarius waved his hand. That's not the point, Cyril. I don't doubt that we'll beat back the Kushans, but I can guarantee that we won't be doing it without suffering lots of casualties and without being exhausted ourselves when the day's over. I don't think we'll be in any shape to be pursuing anybody tomorrow. He rubbed his jaw thoughtfully. I wonder... Belisarius stepped back to the window and looked through the telescope again. For a minute he studied the Kushans taking up their position. Then, pressing himself against the wall to the left of the window, he aimed the telescope at a sharp angle, studying something to the southwest. We've got no troops stationed at the corrals. He cast a quick, inquisitive glance at Boozies. The young Thracian shook his head. No, sir. His tone grew a bit defensive. I thought about it, but it's at least a half a mile away. There didn't seem any point to... Belisarius smiled crookedly. No. There wasn't. I'm not criticizing your decision, Boozies. I just wanted to make sure. Again, Boozies shook his head. We've got nobody there, General. Good, stated Belisarius. He stared through the telescope for another minute before turning away from the window. We're going to turn everything inside out. Instead of waiting until tomorrow, I'll have Morris start the counterattack at the beginning of the battle. He hesitated. Well... Not quite. I don't think the Kushans will lead the first assault. Unless that Malwa commander's dumber than a chicken, he won't want to use his best troops until he's softened this place up a bit. He'll let regulars and Yetai hammer us with grenades, see what happens. If that doesn't work, then he'll send in the Kushans. They'll head up the second attack. And that's when I'll order Morris to make his charge. The look of incomprehension was back on the faces of the general's subordinates. Belisarius's own face broke into a cheerful grin. The trick to dealing with Kushans, I've learned, is to exploit their talents. Begging your pardon, sir, spoke up Cyril, but I don't understand what you're getting at. If Morris attacks when the Kushans are still fresh... What will the Kushans do? Demanded Belisarius. Think, Cyril. And remember, they'll be excellent troops with good commanders on foot, suddenly finding themselves caught between a fortified villa and a heavy cavalry charge on their right flank. Cyril was still frowning. Belisarius drove on. The rest of the Malwa army will be shattering under that charge, not to mention... He turned to Agathius. Are you boys up for another bit of lance work? A sally straight out of the villa? Agathius grinned. After that promenade this morning? Hell yes. It'll be a bitch, mind you, getting the horses through all those little gates. Belisarius waved the matter off. I don't care if the sally's ragged. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that while Morris and Carouche are breaking the Malwa in half from the flank, the front lines of their army see a new threat coming at them straight ahead. The Yetai will go berserk trying to force the regulars to stand and fight, but the Kushans... Sweet Jesus, yes, whispered Boozies. He strode to the window and stared through it at a sharp angle. They'll break for the corrals and the barns and horse pens. Only place around where infantry could ford up and have a chance against heavy cavalry. He stared back at Belisarius. They'll have to react instantly, General. Are they really that good? I'm counting on it, came the firm reply. It's a gamble, I know. If they don't, if they stand their ground, then we'll be in one bloody mess of a brawl. It'll last all day. He shrugged. We'll still win, but half the Malwa army will make their escape. Cyril and Agathius looked at each other, then at Belisarius. Glad I'm not a general, muttered Cyril. I'd die from headache. Agathius tugged at his beard. If I understand correctly, General, you're planning to wreck the Malwa by isolating their best troops while we concentrate on chewing the rest of them to pieces. Belisarius nodded. Agathius's beard tugging grew intense. What's to stop the Kushans from sallying themselves? Coming to the aid of... Boozies grinned. Of what? The same stupid fucking Malwa jackasses who got them treed in the first place? Belisarius shook his head. They won't, Agathius. The Malwa don't trust the Kushans for the good and simple reason that they can't. The Kushans will fight in a battle, but they've got no love for their overlords. When the hammer falls, the Kushans will look out for themselves. He turned to Boozies. After the initial sally, after we break them, move your Syrian troops to cover the Kushans. The infantry can't play any useful role anyway in a pursuit, but don't attack the Kushans. Be a bloodbath if you do. Just hold them there. He grinned himself now. Until tomorrow morning. We'll finish the Kushans then? Asked Kutsis. Belisarius's grin faded to a crooked smile. He made a little fluttering motion with his hands. We'll see, he said. Maybe, maybe not. They're tough, Kushans. But I saw a girl work wonders with them once, using the right words. Half an hour later, the attack began, with a rocket barrage, as Belisarius had predicted. As he watched the rockets soaring all over the sky, exploding haphazardly and landing hither and yon, Belisarius realized that the Malwa were actually doing him a large favor. Although his troops had always maintained a soldierly sang-froid on the subject, he knew that they had been quite apprehensive about the enemy's mysterious gunpowder weapons. Except for Valentinian and Anastasius, who had accompanied him to India, none of Belisarius's men had any real experience with gunpowder weapons. True, most of the soldiers had seen grenades used, some of them had even practiced with the devices, but even his Katyusha rocket men had never seen gunpowder weapons used in the fury and chaos of an actual battle. Now the men were getting their first taste of Malwa gunpowder weapons, and the main result after the first 5 minutes of that barrage was, they'd do better to use scorpions and onagers, commented a Syrian infantryman, crouched behind a plaque-strengthened window not far from the general. A Greek cataphract pressed against a nearby wall barked a laugh. They'd do better to build an assault tower and piss on us, he sneered. The Syrian watched a skittering rocket sail overhead and burst in midair. The man, Belisarius noted, didn't even flinch. In the first moments of the barrage, the Roman soldiers had been shaken by the sound and the fury which the rockets produced, but now, with experience, they were taking the matter in stride. The same Syrian, catching a glimpse of Belisarius, cocked his head and asked, "What's the point of this, sir, if you don't mind my asking?" The infantryman made a little gesture toward the window. "I don't think more than a dozen of these things have exploded anywhere in the compound, and only a few of them has done any real damage, the ones that blew up over the gardens." Don't get too overconfident, men, said Belisarius. He spoke loudly, knowing that all the soldiers crammed into the large room were listening. In the proper circumstances, these rockets can be effective. But you're right. In this situation, they do a lot better to use old-style catapults. Rockets are an area-effect weapon, especially their rockets, which aren't anywhere near as accurate as ours. He paused, allowing the happy thought of Roman rockets to boost morale, before continuing. They're almost useless used against a protected fixed position like this one. The reason the Malwa are using them, he grinned, is because the arrogant bastards are so sure of themselves that they didn't bother to bring any catapults, like we did. The general's grin was answered by a little cheer. When the cheer died down, the Syrian who had spoken up earlier asked another question. How would they be doing if they had those siege guns you've talked about? Belisarius grimaced. It was more of a whimsical expression than a rueful one, however. If they'd had siege guns, I never would have forded us up here in the first place. He waved his hand casually. Big siege guns would flatten a place like this inside of 5 minutes. In 10 minutes, there'd be nothing but rubble. Carefully, gauging, he watched the cheer fade from his soldiers' faces. Then, just before solemnity turned grim, he boomed. On the other hand, siege guns are so big and awkward that they're sitting ducks on a battleground. Again, he waved his hand. The gesture this time wasn't casual in the least. It was the motion of a master craftsman demonstrating an aspect of his skill. If they'd brought siege guns, we'd have ripped them with open field maneuvers. The grin returned. Either way, it doesn't matter, men. We'll thrash the Malwa any way it takes. Outside, two rockets burst in unison. But the sound, loud as it was, completely failed to drown the cheers which erupted through the crowded room. Belisarius! Belisarius! One soldier only in that festive outburst didn't participate in the acclaim. The same Syrian still crouched by the window, still watching everything outside with a keen and vigilant gaze. I think that's it, General, he remarked. I'm pretty sure they're getting ready to charge. Belisarius moved to the window and crouched down next to the soldier. He drew out his telescope and peered through it. For a few seconds, no longer. You're right, he announced. The general leaned over and placed a hand on the Syrian's shoulder. What's your name? He asked softly. The man looked a bit startled. Felix, sir. Felix Calcentris. Belisarius nodded, rose, strode out of the room. In the hallway beyond, he turned right and headed toward the villa's central gardens. The Greek cataphracts massed in the hallway squeezed to the sides, allowing him a narrow passageway through which to move. A very narrow passageway, crooked, cramped, and lined with scale armor. By the time he emerged into the gardens, a bit the way a seed bursts out of a crushed grape, he felt like he had been through a grape press himself. For all its imperial size, the villa was far too small a structure to hold thousands of troops packed within its walls. Still, Belisarius had insisted on crowding as many men as possible into the buildings. The villa wasn't a fortress, but its solidly built walls and roofs provided far more protection from rockets and arrows than the leather screens and canopies which provided the only missile shelter for the troops resting in the villa's open grounds. When he finally emerged into the central gardens, he saw that even here the casualties from the barrage had been very light. This despite the fact that the area was packed as tightly as the buildings were. The horticultural splendor which had once reigned here was nothing but a memory now. Every plant and shrub had been obliterated by the heavily armored men who were jammed into every nook and cranny of the gardens. But few of those men seemed the slightest bit injured. Belisarius was relieved, even though he wasn't surprised. Belisarius had been almost certain that the rocket's trajectories would be too flat to plunge into the gardens. Obviously, his estimate had been correct. What few injuries had occurred had resulted from the handful of rockets which, by bad luck, had exploded directly overhead. And even those had done little damage due to the leather shrapnel screens stretched across much of the garden areas. Again, Belisarius forced his way forward. Once he was through the gardens, he plunged into the jam-packed hallways of the buildings on the opposite side. Squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. By the time he finally staggered into the open grounds in the rear of the villa, he felt almost as if he had been through another lance charge. The expedition had taken much longer than he had expected. No sooner did he emerge into the open than he heard a cacophony of distant shouting behind him. Malwa battle cries. The enemy had launched their ground assault. Belisarius didn't even think of turning back. The thought of undergoing that gauntlet again almost made him shudder. There would be no point, anyway. Buzis was in command of the 3,000 infantrymen manning the villa, with 500 Constantinople cataphracts to back him up. Belisarius was quite confident of their ability to fight off the first attack. Cootes and Agathias, seeing the general emerge, hurried to meet him. Their own pace was not quick. The area to the rear of the villa held the rest of the Greek cataphracts and the Syrian cavalry, over 4,000 men along with their horses. But the population density was not as extreme as it had been in the villa itself. The imperial compounds, walled and closed western grounds, were many acres in extent. Open areas, for the most part, interspersed with bridle paths, hedges, patios, and scattered trees. Within a few seconds, Belisarius was consulting with his cavalry commanders. All three of them spoke loudly due to the rapidly escalating noise coming from the other side of the villa. Malwa and Roman battle cries were mingled with the sound of grenade explosions. Belisarius's first words were, "How many casualties?" "They'd have done better to use catapults," snorted Agathias. He looked at Cootes. "What would you say? 20, maybe? Overall?" Cootes shrugged. "If that many, only 3 fatalities that I know of." "What about the horses?" asked the general. Agathias rocked his head back and forth. "They're a little skittish, General, but we were able to keep them pretty much under control. Don't think we lost more than 12. Most of those will be back in a few hours, except a couple who broke their fool necks jumping the rear wall." Cootes laughed. "I don't think Abu's precious horse will be coming back. I swear, General, the fucking thing almost jumped over the trees as well as the wall." Agathias grinned. Belisarius's eyes widened. "Abu's? You mean that gelding he dotes on?" "Dotes on?" demanded Cootes. "That gelding's the apple of the old brigand's eye. He practically sleeps with the damn beast." "Not anymore," chuckled Agathias. "He's fit to be tied, he is. Last I saw, he was standing on the wall shooting arrows at the creature. Didn't come close, of course. The gelding was already halfway to Antioch." Belisarius shook his head. He was smiling, but the smile was overlaid with concern. "Did he manage—" Cootes cut him off. "Don't worry, General. Abu sent the Arab couriers off as soon as we gave him the word. 30 minutes ago, at least. Mars will have plenty of warning that the plans have changed." Belisarius's smile grew very crooked. "I'm glad I won't be there to hear him cursing me for a fuss budget." He did a fair imitation of Morris's rasping voice. "What am I, a babe in swaddling clothes? A toddler has to be told to pay attention because plans are changing? Of course the plan's changing. Am I the one who taught that general that plans always change when the enemy arrives?" Cootes grinned. Agathias's expression was serious. "You think he'll be ready then?" he asked. "I'll admit I'm a bit worried about it. They weren't expecting to be called on this soon." Belisarius clapped a hand on Agathias' heavy shoulder. "Don't," he said softly. "If there's one thing in this world you can be sure of, it's that Morris won't ever be caught napping in a battle. The only reason I sent the couriers was to make sure he'd move out the second we fired the signal rockets instead of 15 seconds later." He turned to Cootes. "Speaking of which..." Cootes pointed to a small copse of trees 50 yards distant. "In there, General. Aimed and ready to fire as soon as you give the word. One red, followed by a green, and we've got 3 backup rockets of each color in case one of them misfires." Belisarius nodded. He turned his head back toward the villa, listening to the sound of the battle. Even buffered by the villa, the noise was intense. Intense and growing more so by the second. The grenade explosions were almost continuous now. The general and his two officers listened for perhaps a minute without speaking, and Cootsies stated very firmly, "Not a chance." Agathias immediately nodded. So did Belisarius. All three men had reached the same assessment just from the sound of the battle. For all the evident fury with which the Malwa were pressing the attack, their efforts would be futile. There had been not a trace of the unmistakable sounds of defenders losing heart. Not one cry of despair, not one desperate shriek. Only a steady roar of Roman battle cries and shouts of confident triumph. The assault would break, recoil. The Malwa staggered away, trailing small rivers of blood. Belisarius turned away from the villa and quickly scanned the area. "You're ready." It was a statement, not a question. Agathias and Buzis didn't even bother to speak their affirmation. The general sighed. "Nothing for it, then." He looked back at the villa, wincing. "Back into the vice for me." He began walking toward the buildings, saying over his shoulder, "I'll have the message relayed. Watch for it. Fire off the rockets at once." To his relief, the crowd had thinned out a bit, in the rear buildings at least. All of the soldiers who could had forced themselves into the buildings directly facing the Malwa, fired with determination to help beat off the attack. It only took Belisarius a couple of minutes to thread his way back to the central gardens. There, however, he was stopped cold, cursed himself for a fool. He had forgotten that he had given orders the day before to use the gardens as a field hospital. The grounds were completely impassable now. The casualties weren't particularly severe given the situation, but wounded men along with their attendants take up more space than men standing. As he scrutinized the scene, a part of Belisarius was grimly pleased with what he saw. Outside of the terrible losses suffered by a routed army being pursued, there was no kind of battle which produced casualties as quickly as a close assault on field works. Most of those casualties, of course, would be inflicted on the attackers, but the defenders would take their share also. Yet what he now saw in the gardens were light casualties given the circumstances, and, even better, a much higher proportion of men wounded rather than killed compared to the usual. The screens worked, by God. He had thought they would. Malwa grenades, like Roman ones, were ignited by hand-lit fuses. It was almost inevitable that the man lighting that fuse would cut it a bit too long, from fear of having the bomb blow up in his hand. The Malwa would have concentrated their grenades on the many doors and portals which lined the villa's walls and buildings. With the screens in place, put up almost instantly, without warning, the Malwa grenades would have bounced off and exploded too far away to do any concussive damage. True, shrapnel would pierce the leather, would eventually shred the screens entirely, but the screens had served to blunt the fury of the first assault, and almost all the Roman casualties had been relatively minor wounds caused by leather-deflected shrapnel. Pleased as he was, however, Belisarius didn't spend much time examining the scene. He was too preoccupied with the unexpected problem of getting himself to a position where he could assess the next Malwa attack. The attack, he was certain, would be spearheaded by the Kushans. Timing would be all important then, and he couldn't possibly order Morris's attack when he had no idea what was happening. For a moment, he considered working his way to the front by circumnavigating the interconnected buildings which made up the compound. But he dismissed the idea almost immediately. Every one of those buildings would be so jam-packed with soldiers as to make forward progress all but impossible. He had just about come to the grotesque but inescapable conclusion that he was going to have to make his way through the gardens by walking on the bodies of wounded men when he heard his name called. "General Belisarius! General Belisarius, over here!" He looked across the gardens. Standing in a doorway on the opposite side was the same infantryman he had spoken with earlier. Felix. Felix Calcentris. "You won't be able to get across, sir," shouted the Syrian soldier. "The Kiliarch sent me back here to watch for you. Wait a minute, just a minute." The man disappeared. He returned about a minute later, preceded by Buzis. As soon as he stepped into the doorway, Buzis cupped his hands around his mouth, forming an impromptu megaphone, and hollered, "Let's set up a relay, with your permission, sir." Belisarius thought the problem over. For a second or two, no more. He nodded and waved his hand. Then, copying Boozy's handcuffing, shouted back, "Good idea. Leave Felix in the door. If the Kushans lead the next charge, let me know." He paused, taking a deep breath before continuing, "If they do, tell me the moment they start their charge." Boozy's waved back, acknowledging. The Kiliarch spoke a few words to Felix and disappeared. The Syrian soldier remained in the doorway. His stance was erect and alert. Even from the distance, Belisarius could see the stern expression on the man's face. A young face, it was, almost a boy's face. But it was also the face of a man determined to do his duty come what may. Belisarius smiled. "You're in for a promotion, lad," he whispered. "As soon as the battle's over, I think." The general now concentrated on listening. The sounds of battle had died away in the last few minutes. Clearly enough, the Malwa had been beaten back and were regrouping. He decided he had enough time to make his own preparations. Again, he made his way back through the rear building and onto the western grounds. Agathias was waiting not 20 feet from the doorway. The Constantinople cataphract was already mounted on his horse. Quickly, Belisarius explained the signal relay. "Then, it'll be a few minutes. Get me a horse, will you? I won't be relaying the message. I'll just come straight back and join you." He pointed to the doorway. "As soon as you see me coming through that door, have the Cornisons order the sally. That'll give me just enough time to mount up." Agathias nodded, then with a frown. "Where are your bodyguards?" Belisarius shrugged, smiling whimsically. "We got separated, it seems. They must be lost in the crowd." The Greek Kiliarch's frown deepened. "I'm not sure I like that, General. The idea of you leading a sally without your bodyguards, I mean." Belisarius scowled. "I assure you, Agathias, I was taking care of myself long before—" "Still, enough." Agathias opened his mouth, closed it. "Yes, sir. It'll be as you say." Belisarius nodded and strode back toward the gardens. This time, as he made his way through the building, he ordered the men inside to clear a lane for him. "I'll be coming through here soon enough, running as fast as I can. I warn you, boys, I'll trample right over the man standing in my way. And I'm wearing spurs, I hope you notice." The soldiers grinned, pressed aside, cheered. "Belisarius! Belisarius!" His only acknowledgement. "That sorry bastard will be fucked." 10 minutes later, Felix called out the news across the gardens. "The Kushans are lining up. They'll be leading the attack." 5 minutes after, he shouted, "They're coming!" Then, "Now! Now! Now!" For a man wearing full cataphract armor, Belisarius thought he did quite well racing, so to speak, through the building. The men who formed the flesh and steel walls on both sides certainly thought so, judging from their encouragement. "Belisarius! Belisarius! Go, General! Go! Go!" And one enthusiast, "God damn, that man can waddle!" As soon as he burst out of the doorway onto the grounds, the cornison started blowing. From the corner of his eye, Belisarius caught the red and green bursts of the signal rockets. But the sole focus of his eyes was the saddled and readied horse ahead of him. Belisarius almost stumbled then from sheer surprise. Standing by the horse, ready to hoist the general aboard, was Anastasius. The giant's own charger was not far away with a mounting stool at its side. "How did you get here?" demanded the general.
"Don't ask," grunted Anastasius, heaving Belisarius under the horse by sheer brute strength. The huge cataphract headed for his own horse. Belisarius gathered up the reins. He could see the mass of Greek cataphracts and Syrian light cavalry starting their sally. The horsemen were already dividing into columns, splitting around the villa, heading for the portals and the opposite walls. A part of his mind noticed that their formations were good, reasonably orderly, and, best of all, well organized. The rest of his mind, briefly, wrestled with a mystery. "How did you get here?" he asked again, this time to the man already mounted and ready at his side.
"Don't ask," hissed Valentinian.
The cataphract gave Anastasius a weasel glare.
"His doing. Impossible, I told him. Even Moses couldn't part that mob."
Anastasius, trotting up on his horse, caught the last words. A grin split his rock-hewn face.
"Moses wasn't as big as I am," he said.
He extended his enormous hand like an usher.
After you, sir. Victory is waiting.
So it is, cried Belisarius.
So it is.
He spurred his mount into a gallop. He wasn't worried about exhausting his horse now. They didn't have far to go. He was only concerned with getting to the front of the charge and leading it to victory. By the time he pounded around the villa and saw the nearest portal, he had achieved that immediate goal. The Syrian infantrymen, who were hastily opening the gates, tossing aside the splintered wreckage of the gates more precisely, barely had time to dodge aside before Belisarius drove past. Valentinian and Anastasius came right behind, followed by droves of cataphracts. The infantrymen were cheering wildly. The cataphracts were bellowing their battle cries. But Belisarius only had ears for an expected mutter. It never came. He glanced over his shoulder, cocking a quizzical eye. A weasel's glare met his gaze.
A weasel's hiss? What's the fucking use?
Chapter 20. The general's first thought as he came around the villa onto its eastern grounds was to make a quick assessment of the tactical situation. He'd seen nothing of the battle directly since his return to the villa after the first cavalry charge. That urgent purpose almost led him to an immediate and humiliating downfall. Downfall in the literal sense. Dead, dying, and badly wounded Malwa soldiers were scattered all across the grounds in front of the villa. In places, the bodies were piled 2 and 3 deep. Belisarius was concentrating so intently on the live Malwa troops that he was oblivious to the obstacles posed by the dead ones. His mount stumbled on a corpse and almost spilled his rider. Only the superhuman reflexes which aid gave him enabled Belisarius to keep himself in the saddle and his horse on its feet. First things first, he snarled at himself. For the next few seconds, until he was through the carnage on the villa's eastern grounds, he ignored everything but leading his horse forward. Only a cold, distant, and detached part of his mind took note of the terrible losses the enemy had suffered in their first assault. Arrow wounds in the main, although a number of the Malwa casualties had apparently been caused by their own grenades bouncing off the screens. Finally, he was through the mounded bodies and could concentrate on the active enemy. His first concern was with the Katyushas. He could already hear the hissing shriek of the rockets, unmistakably different from the sound produced by Malwa rockets. The Roman missiles, following Belisarius's instructions, had been fitted with machined bronze venturi. The evenly distributed thrust provided by those exhaust nozzles made his Katyusha rockets far more accurate than their Malwa counterparts. They also made a distinctively different noise. He couldn't see the rocket chariots themselves. The Katyushas would be charging at the Malwa from their hiding place in the northeast woods, followed by the Thracian and Illyrian cataphracts. A screen of trees blocked Belisarius's view in that direction, but he could see the rockets themselves. The first volley was even now impacting on the enemy. He watched a line of explosions stitching its way across the Malwa army's right flank, knocking cavalrymen out of saddles and their horses to the ground. He held his breath. That first volley had come perilously close to landing in the very center of the enemy formation, where the Mahaveda priests were perched atop the gunpowder wagons. It was no part of his plan to have that ammunition. His held-in breath exploded. The second and third volleys did land in the center of the enemy, several of them right among the wagons. Many of the priests standing on those wagons were swept off as if by a broom. One of the wagons was tipped over by a rocket exploding almost directly beneath it. The ammunition cart teetered on 2 wheels. Teetered, teetered, before finally slamming back down. One of the wheels collapsed under the shock. Belisarius hunched low, waiting for the whole ammunition supply to blow up. He turned his head and began yelling at the men behind him to brace themselves for the eruption. Then, abruptly stopped. There had been no explosion. Astonished, he turned his head back and saw that, for all the destruction strewn by the Katyushas, the Malwa ammunition had not caught fire. An arrow sailing past his head reminded him that there were other dangers. The first ranks of dismounted Malwa regulars were less than 150 yards away. The enemy soldiers were obviously confused by the sudden and unexpected attack on their flank, but many of them still had enough presence of mind to fire arrows at the Romans sallying from the villa. Their arrows were neither well-aimed nor fired in coordination, however. Belisarius was about to congratulate himself for surprising his enemy again when another flight of arrows erased all sense of self-satisfaction. Those arrows were well-aimed and had been fired in a coordinated volley from 100 yards away. The volley looked like a flight of homing pigeons coming toward him unerringly from his right front. The general raised his shield, crouching in the saddle as best he could. No less than 3 glanced off his shield, another off the armor guarding his mount's withers, and a 5th painfully on his heavily armored right arm. Fortunately, the bow which had launched that arrow lacked the power of a cataphract bow. The arrowhead failed to penetrate the scale armor, although Belisarius was quite sure he would be sporting a bad bruise by morning. The rest of the volley landed amidst the cataphracts following him. From the cries of pain and surprise, he knew that many had hit their targets. When the general peeked over the rim of his shield, looking forward and to his right, he saw what he expected to see. The Grushans were already forming a square, shields interlocked, spears bristling, with a line of archers standing right behind the shield wall. The Grushan commander had instantly assessed the new situation and was doing the best thing he could under the circumstances. Hunker down, snarl, and bristle like a porcupine surrounded by wolves. Smart wolves hunt easier prey. So did Belisarius. He angled his horse to the left, guiding his men away from the Kushan formation. He would ride in a shallow arc around the Kushans and fall on the disorganized mass of Marvel regulars who had been following the Kushan vanguard. His cataphracts, no fools themselves, immediately followed his lead. None of them, in Belisarius's column, even fired back at the Kushans. The general had led the sally erupting from the northern portals and gates of the villa. The Kushans, therefore, were to their right as they galloped past.